Hello and welcome to a truly special episode of the Offside Musings podcast. My name is Oke Ndibe, and it's my delight to welcome you on behalf of my co-host, Emeka Onyeagwan. I said that today is a truly special podcast because we have a distinguished and special guest on today's program. Her name is a household name for people who have been in the civil liberties domain within Nigeria and beyond. And today's podcast is part of our occasional series on civil liberties in Nigeria and in Africa. As I said, our guest is Ayo Obei. I'm going to if I wanted to give her a real introduction, it's going to take quite a while. But she's given me permission to give a handkerchief introduction. So Ayobe Ni Ogunshola is a legal practitioner and a partner with Olashupo Shonibare in the Lagos-based law firm Ogunshola Shonibare. She is a trustee of Senegal's Gorée Institute and of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group. In Nigeria, she's on the board of the Z.O. Dibiezue Memorial Libraries and is an active member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. Mrs. Obey was president of the Civil Liberties Organization and has also been chair of the Transition Monitoring Group, an election monitoring slash democracy building coalition of independent NGOs, the Steering Committee of the World Movement for Democracy and Nigerian Civil Society's Panel on Police Reform in Nigeria. She represented Nigerian human rights NGOs on the Police Service Commission from 2001 to 2006 and was a trustee of the CLEEN Foundation from 2001 to 2015. Mrs. Obey has written weekly columns on current affairs for Sunday Punch, Next, and The Guardian, and delivered several lectures and papers on a range of human rights and democracy-related subjects. She presented You and the Constitution and On Point for the Nigerian Television Authority and Ideas Radio, a program about integrity, ethics, and accountability in democracy on Nigeria's Info 97/3 FM. Ayo Obey, it's such a joy, such a delight, such a privilege to invite you to our podcast, Offside Musings.
Welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Although I have to say, okay, that was a little bit of a puffed up introduction. And though, yes, I did send you my brief biography, you'll notice that most of the things that are listed there, although there are some things that are current, but most of it relates to the distant past. And in fact, I laugh when you say a household name, because I cannot be a household name to half the people in the country who, as we know, are under the age of is it 15 or 25 or whatever.
Yes.
And so I'm not sure that when you say when you introduce a dinosaur like me, that they're saying, oh yes, we know her. I mean, I used to do a weekly interview on Silverbird Television, and I really just stopped doing my radio program. But otherwise, if you might follow me on Twitter, but otherwise, they don't necessarily know me, so.
Well, let me say that I was speaking for people of my generation, which is, in a sense, roughly your generation, when I said that you are a household name. For us,
Thank
for
you.
me, you are a household, and I'm sure that a lot of people within a certain demographic in Nigeria would not have any issues with that description. So let's get to it because you've been very kind with your time, and but you also indicated that you're not going to have a whole lot of time. As you said to me when I invited you to come on this podcast, you said that anything that cannot be said within 20 minutes should be put in a book, that one should write a book, which is great advice for writers like me, because I feel that I haven't written enough books, but I go on and talk quite a bit. But let's talk about an item in your biography that I just read, which is a Bring Back Our Girls campaign.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have put this on the back burner. They don't know that there is still an ongoing activist movement demanding that the government not relent in the bid, in the quest to recover all the girls who were captured by Boko Haram. Could you speak to the nature of that movement in relation to your involvement in it?
I might say, okay, that, you know, we're recording this interview or this discussion on the weekend after the invasion of Israel, parts of Israel, by Hamas. And without going into the rights or wrongs or any other aspect of it, we know that more than 100 people have been taken as hostages to into Gaza by Hamas. Mm-hmm. And while I certainly recognize that there are Palestinian prisoners who are being held in Israeli jails and so on, I think that the quality of the fact of being taken a hostage, it kind of brings it home to me, because I may say that I'm not a terribly religious person, but I do pray in the mornings. And one of the things I pray for is for the release of all these hostages in Nigeria. Because, as you know, it's not just the Chibok girls who are kidnapped, but that, you know, even now, we, even though it may not be for political reasons, as the Boko Haram purported to, you have people being taken by bandits for ransom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't help but feeling that even if you're taken by the police, you can, there's somebody you can see and hold responsible. Mm-hmm. When you're kidnapped by bandits and so on, the trauma is that you don't know where your loved one or your friend is. You don't know the conditions under which they're being held. You don't even know if they're not actually at risk of being slaughtered, as some of the hostages in Nigeria had been. Because when we talk about the Chibok girls, we also had the Red Cross and the United Nations workers who were kidnapped, and two of them were killed by then. I think it was either Islamic State or Boko Haram. And it's very gruesome. So that uncertainty about the fate of your loved one is, I don't know many people in Israel, but the one that I know, I said that it's really not useful to ask, are you yourself okay? Because mm-hmm. you may be okay and be worried sick about friends and family. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it kind of underlines the trauma of people who have lost their loved ones. And in Nigeria, of course, the Boko Haram terrorists, you know, I think what really sparked the movement off was the complete denial by the government that there's no kidnapping. Then there was the sort of blame shifting. Well, the governor shouldn't have had their elections, so on and so forth. And all these excuses and so on. And for me, the reason I joined, the main reason that made me join, was because I do recognize that the gap in educational attainment between the North and South is one of the factors that can lead to disunity in the country. And mm-hmm. I do feel that when girls in particular go to school and then they end up being discouraged by being kidnapped, or and of course, you know, the weekend, a few weeks before, there had been the slaughter of schoolboys at Bunuyadi, another secondary school in the North. And so I sort of felt that, you know, this is designed to prevent people in the North from being interested in education, and that's not going to be good for the country as a whole. It's really not just enough to say, well, I'm all right, my family is all right, so and so on, but to recognize what the implications of this might be for the long time, for the long time future of the country. And then, of course, as one of the women who attended today's sit out, because you know we sit out from 12 till 1 every week in Lagos at Falomo. And she said that, look, she was listening to, she was hearing a report of a woman from Kano who was just going home and she was kidnapped for, they were demanding 5.5 million. And she said that, look, she thought it was even school children that they were kidnapping. And now here they are, they're kidnapping ordinary women like herself. And so she, even though she's in Lagos, she just does not feel safe about herself. But I think that the main reason why the Chibok girls became the issue was because before we would talk in these terms, vague terms, about 20 people arrested, 30 people killed, 50 kidnapped, and so on. And we didn't bother with any identity for them. We didn't bother to put names, we didn't bother to put faces to them, and we didn't bother to put numbers to them. So we didn't know. But with the Chibok girls, we knew who they were. We knew the numbers. We knew the names. And so we thought, look, let these stand in the gap for all the people. Because, of course, as the army, Nigerian army, has been progressing and advancing into the areas that used to be controlled by Boko Haram, you know, you just found many people being released. The Chibok girls were, quote unquote, famous. But it turned out that there were huge numbers that really we hadn't paid much attention to, we didn't know much about, and so on. And generally, the sort of, you know, it's irritating when people sort of act as though, you know, because we actually had to, when the Black Lives Matter movement arose halfway into the captivity of these Chibok girls, you know, we said, look, this we can't talk in Nigeria because, you know, they'll be saying Black Lives Matter and the Nigerian government has to say anything. They will say, mm-hmm. but Black lives don't matter in your own country. So, you can't come out here and talk because you don't behave like people to whom Nigerian lives matter. So, you know, please take a back seat. And that, again, it sort of, we say that, but, you know, even though we take this, I think that it's because we have to adopt a kind of stoic behavior, a stoic face to the world. And, you know, maybe not weep as much as people might in other countries, because what can you do? You are helpless. You feel that there's so little that you can do that you adopt. You put on a straight face, and then people say, "I see they don't even their lives are not important to them. They don't really care," and so. And you know, because when you saw some of those girls who were returned during the first years of the Buhari administration, you had to see the joy. One of the mothers, she took her daughter, by now was, I think she was 18, and she put her on her back like a baby and was carrying her and, you know, dancing around with her, that, you know, and she was so happy. She was so happy. And, you know, you just realize that there are, that people may not be very articulate in their expression of distress, but our government should not take that as, you know, just move on. You know, oh, well, it's really sorry. Oh, I came here to, you know, thoughts and prayers. Let's move on. I say that you cannot move on. You know the names of these girls. You know how many of them are missing. You need to, you're responsible for them.
Absolutely.
You, as government, are responsible for them. And we can't, you know, it's not a matter of, as Mrs. Patience Jonathan said at the time, you know, the people in the north, they bomb, begin, throw away. And, you know, it's that sort of mentality that certain types of people's lives are less important than they are. Now, of course, to me, my own life and that of my family's life is more important to me. My friends' lives are more important to me. But at the same time, I can't separate the overall picture. you know, as you know, okay, I've said many times that I'm a big believer in enlightened self-interest. So it's not just that a matter of, oh, it would all be nice if we could all be good Christians or good Muslims or whatever we follow and do the right thing and so on. But when I talk about enlightened self-interest is there because it actually, you know, in the end, and this to me is the whole story of human rights and all the rest of it, in the end, that's what works for everybody, not just for some. And so that's is why the movement is there. Of course, at the beginning, you know, and you do hear people saying, well, all the celebrities are no longer interested, and Michelle Obama is, has she said anything? You say, look, you know, at the end of the day, this is not about who is standing in the gap. It's about the girls and the kidnapped victims. That's what this is about. It's not about whether people are standing. I mean, there are times when I've been to the sit out, and there have only been about two of us or three of us. And of course, on weekends when we have, you know, the marathon, when there's no movement of traffic, or election weekends, when there's no movement again. Since I live within walking distance, I try to get up to the roundabout just to occupy the space for that brief period to say that somebody is still standing in the gap for these girls.
Well, thank you very much. Let's. I'm going to sort of take you back to one of those moments, one of those activities that, in my view, made you known to me and known to quite a few people, and that's your involvement with the Civil Liberties Organization, which at one point was the most important organization that was advancing, catalyzing the cause of civil liberties in Nigeria. Would you please give us a sense of the genesis of that organization and how you came to be part of it and ultimately, at some point, the president of CLO?
Well, I know more about it now because I've been helping one of the key actors to edit the book that he's written about his own involvement in the movement. But I was not there at the beginning at all. I wasn't part of the founders. And it just happened that, unfortunately, when I'm talking to you, I'm talking more like an Oyinbo than a Niger. But I had just come back to Nigeria to go to law school in 1977. And, you know, I was a complete JJC. I didn't know anybody. And quite frankly, if I opened my mouth, my voice would sound so Oyinbo-ish. So I kept my head down at law school. And but when we got to our 10th anniversary, I called two of my friends who had been with me in law school, Ifoma, and now Mrs. Esiri and Tukumbo Sofola. I said, look, you know, let's have lunch because we're now 10 years at the bar. That means we can become judges, we can become senior advocates of Nigeria, with this and that. So let's have lunch. And so, you know, the three of us were just going to have lunch. And then I heard people, they were calling me, they would say, Ayo, I hear you're planning a lunch. Ayo, I hear you're planning a lunch. And I said, I'm planning a lunch. But anyway, at the time, we sat down to this lunch. There were 30 of us. And that was how I got to know more of my classmates from the time when I was in law school than I might have known otherwise. And one of them happened to be Olisa Agbakoba. And then shortly after that, there was this story in the paper that the people that they had released from years in detention from the time of Gowon, who had been arrested for wandering and silly offences like that, that they can't just release us like that. So you have to give us money to go home. Our people have forgotten us. Just give us money. And so I saw Lisa. I said, of course, no good deed goes unpunished. Is there anything I can do to help? And that was how I got involved, really, in the Civil Liberties Organization. But I just used to turn up. And of course, at that time, there was this whole Babangida transition that was going on. And it was expected that we would return to civil war. And I'd just... because I was now a mother and I had left GOK at JE, I perhaps had a bit more control of my time. So I was attending one of the CLO meetings you know, and they said, well, we're going to have a new constitution, and we're going to have a deputy president. But before there had just been Olisa, treasurer, and so on, so and I think executive director. And so Abdoloro and Chidi Odinkalu, they now talked me into standing for election as deputy president. That's how I stood. So I stood for election as deputy president, got elected. I may say that that was the only election that I was, time I was elected to a position in the CLO, because by the time, you know, it came to be, Olisa said, well, now under our constitution, I'm standing down after 8 years. And I was the obvious person that should stand for president, but nobody else would stand for the job at that time, because we had Olisa. So Olisa was standing down. Then we had Abdoloro, Chima Ubani, who were in detention because they had suggested that Abacha's phantom coup was indeed a phantom coup. So they were in detention with Dr. Tunji Abayomi. And so nobody wanted the job, quite frankly. So that's how I became president. But I think it's more a matter of, you know, you attend meetings. And quite frankly, I don't know whether it's legal training that makes you learn to, that makes you more accustomed to speaking out than not. But I would attend meetings and I would always generally have something to say. And I think that's what makes people say, oh, yeah, let's let her go and, you know, do this, let's appoint her to this position. And in fact, at today's meeting of the Bring Back Our Girls Sit Out, there's one woman who attends, Florence Ojo. You'll see her on my Twitter feed. And I had passed her on my way to the, from where I parked to walking to Falomo. And so when she came, and she was just going to, I said, no, Francie, I'm going to sit down this time. You have to talk. And which is, I don't know what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. And I said, you should just speak. If people were laughing at Badibor Road's 504, his Yoruba, you need to hear me to hear your ears. your head will scatter. But, you know, when I'm talking to Bring Back Others, I have to try and do my best and try and speak some Yoruba too, because many of the people who are participating, they're more comfortable with that language, even as mangled by me. So I was making her speak, and then afterwards I was saying to them, look, that this is, you know, a training ground for us, because, you know, we've written to the Minister for Humanitarian Affairs that we want a complete report on the Chibok girls. We know that some have died. We know that some have been rescued. We know that some escaped in, and we know that some are still in captivity, and we need to have clarity about them. And your ministry, so we've written to her, and, you know, we said, supposing she were to now come and join us, that, you know, if she were to come, and she would say, what do you have to say? And we would all be just looking and sort of thing. So we have to practice. We have to practice finding our voice to be able to speak out. No matter how humble we think we are, no matter how important we think the other person is, that we should practice to bring back our girls. It's a bit of a training ground too for people to just be able to voice their position. But that was also what got me into not just the civil liberties organization, but then when I was invited to take part in the first meeting of the world, what eventually became the World Movement for Democracy. I think I was asked to chair one panel, which I chaired, but then we were to now do the final statement. And it was held in New Delhi. And though people had come from Pakistan, you know, there was this sort of tension between what the people who had come, I mean, the people from all over the world. And we, of course, as Africans, were complaining that, you know, we were completely left out of the thing. Well, you know, where was Africa reflected in this? But, you know, there was clearly some argy-bargy between the Indian and Pakistani delegates. And I remember Larry Diamond saying that, pointing to me and saying that this is a person that can, you know, bring them together so that they will be able to, you know, so we would get a final statement out. And so we got the final statement out. But after that, I was now appointed to chair the steering committee of the World Movement for Democracy. And I always say to my daughter, when she's mumbling something at me, I said that, look, you know, half of the things that people appoint me to is because they can understand what I'm saying. Mm. They can hear me clearly. I'm not mumbling. They're not saying, so what did you say? I hear you.
So CLO operated mostly in the military era, era of military rule.
Mm.
What were some of the causes that the organization took on? And what were some of the problems, that challenges that you faced as an organization, or perhaps even personally?
Well, I would say that when I joined the CLO in 1992, and then I did not become president until 1995. And okay. I had just become president when the Ogoni Nine were executed by the Abacha regime. And at that time, the CLO had delegated Olisa and others to go to the meeting of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in New Zealand to, you know, to get them to speak up on behalf of the Ogoni Nine, who are under the, who were by then condemned prisoners. And you know, to intercede for them. But it was almost as if, you know, I want to cut off any possibility that we can, that I can be spoken to, so I'm going to execute everybody. So, and that caused a lot of outrage. And so almost immediately I had become prime, the president, I had to be, the Ugandan government, yeah, the Ugandan government of Yoweri Museveni of those days had agreed to host a meeting of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. And one of the issues that they were going to, the main issue was going to be the situation in Nigeria, where the Ogoni Nine had been executed. And, you know, we had come through the Babangida era. And although Babangida came in 1985 and he was releasing prisoners up and down and was going to be fine and all the rest of it, he soon showed his true colors, because the jails just were filling back up again with different people. And all the time he was trying to work out how can he maneuver himself back into power so that he will be... you know, because he really did not want to leave. He liked being president of Nigeria. And, you know, we can see now that if he had perhaps let go for 4 years or even 8 years, he could have been back. But as it was, we were now back in the doldrums and Babangida would not let go. So it was really, the CLO was dealing with individual cases of people whose rights were being trampled upon. The same issues that perhaps, you know, when you're under a military dictatorship, you don't have so many, you don't have so much, so many remedies, because at the end of the day, if they really want to keep you locked up, they will just say, they will get a decree to order that leads to your indefinite detention. And of course, although Babangida had repealed Buhari's decree number 4, which was the one which we're always supposed to call it the infamous or whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's one journalistic cliche that always
goes along. Yeah.
Obnoxious is the word, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes,
obnoxious.
Yes.
Obnoxious.
Yes, obnoxious decree 4, yes.
You know, you have to, so they had repealed that because it said that if you make fun of any public officer, even if the fun is based on something true,
even if it is true, yeah.
But the thing is that people, I think, were more... but Babangida, nonetheless, was still operating a very draconian measure, way of not necessarily locking people up for what they wrote, but closing down newspapers, arresting journalists, and so on and so forth. And so the freedom of speech was still very much something that we were fighting for the space to occupy. And those were the days of what they called guerrilla journalism, where you had the news magazines, which were really mostly at the forefront of the struggle. And they would, be publishing in, they couldn't publish on glossy paper anymore. They had to publish on newsprint as news magazines. And of course, the Abacha regime was unable to clamp down on it. They did what they could. And then they even tried to publish fake copies of these news magazines and try and sell them. But of course, okay, what can I say now? The whole environment is different now. Not just as regards the fact of the broadcast media, but also the fact of the social media.
Social media.
And, right now the government says it's consulting with Google, TikTok,
Twitter.
I still call it Twitter because I think X is a ridiculous, ridiculously undistinguished. But anyway, they're discussing with them to see how can we regulate social media, because I think that although there tends to be a knee-jerk reaction among the the free speech community that no, there must be everybody must be able to say whatever they like, there is a recognition that it's actually we really are, our national unity is not strong enough to withstand everything that is being thrown at it. And
are you talking specifically of Nigeria now?
Well, I quite frankly, I think that if you go to the United States, you probably find the same thing. In most countries,
So would you argue then that on account of threats, quote unquote, threats to national unity or integrity of nations, that we should consider some way of regulating speech on social media?
I think that we actually see that it is in fact being regulated. It may not be being regulated in the United States, but certainly in the continent of Europe, it is regulated.
Yes.
There are some things you cannot say. I mean, the whole superstructure of not being able to talk about the Nazis or express any Holocaust denial and so on and so forth. Those are part of restrictions that their free speech faces. And I think for us, the problem is not really that people don't actually recognize that something has to be done. It's more that who is going to be doing the regulating? Because the people doing the regulating are not, they have their baggage, let's put it like that. They have their issues.
They're interested parties, as it were.
They're interested parties. But then, okay, I can also say that when people say that, it is, if you are on one side, you see everybody who is not 180% in your camp as also being an interested party. So, I mean, when I was doing my radio program, or when I talk on Silverbird, I think partly it comes with the training as a lawyer. You cannot be a lawyer without going into your contest and not know what your other side may be thinking. You don't go into your contest imagining that the other side are idiots or insane. You have to also put them yourself to some extent in their shoes and say, if I were in this position, what would be my position? What would I say? Why would I, what would be the argument that I would make? And so, you see that it's not that I think you're completely crazy, although in some things people are crazy, but if I say that this is my choice, it doesn't mean to say that because I have not agreed with you that I think you should be consigned to the innermost depths of hell. I mean, I was listening to the Israeli ambassador addressing the Nigerian media, and he was saying it's a choice between good and evil. And I said, well, you know, if you're in, it's either Hamas. And I said, no, it's not, actually. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. It is not a choice between good and evil, because there is evil on both sides.
Yeah.
And so to you, you can't force us into, you know, as, I don't know if you've seen that famous cartoon that sort of say, this is what it's like on social media, that you say, you know, actually, I think I prefer mangoes to bananas. And then, so you hate bananas. What have you got against bananas? Why are you so anti-banana? And all the rest of it. Just said I prefer mangoes.
Yes.
I prefer mangoes today. Mm-hmm. You know, but you're always being, and I was, and quite frankly, having watched some of the interviews of people on the issue of Israel and the Hamas invasions, the way people are being pushed into corners. If you are not with us, you must be against us. You cannot. And as I say, what is behind the six of Israel's response? Invade, you know, attempts to invade or preparation to invade is more than just the seven of Hamas's atrocities. You know, we have this saying in Nigeria: what is behind six is more than just seven. Mm-hmm. And there's all the numbers leading to infinity. And this is the situation with us too in Nigeria. It's never that there's all one; everything is all on one side, and something is else on the other side. I find it difficult to live in this world of extremes where everything is black or white, good or bad, evil or holy. No, no.
So let me because as somebody who I actually am not one of the greatest participants in social media, but then I'm very, very worried about attempts by governments, because I sort of see governments as entities that maintain monopolies on violence, the means of violence. They maintain monopolies on money. Governments want to control the space of currency. And as much as possible, governments want to control, if they can get away with it, information. Or what I call disinformation, actually, because a lot of what governments do is to spread lies, to spread falsehood in advance of their programs. So attempts by governments to legislate what is true and what is false and what you can say and what you can't say trouble me quite a bit. And I think that a lot of it came out during COVID, where people who would ask questions about the vaccines, and these were not quote unquote anti-vaxxers, but everybody was reduced. If you asked any questions, you were an anti-vaxxer. But there are people who are taking every vaccine that was due them, but they had questions about the speed and the testing of the vaccines that were produced. And the response was, you don't believe in science, you're an anti-vaxxer. Social media was often asked by governments to shut down even vaccinologists, virologists who were asking questions about the vaccine. So I'm scared of governments legislating that kind of thing. But let me sort of, because our constituency is mostly Nigerian.
Okay, that wasn't even legislation. Actually the pressure from governments on the social media.
Precisely. So it was the government trying to, as it were, arbitrate what should be. You know, it's like some doctors said that hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin were highly effective in treating the virus, right? I took ivermectin when I had COVID. Yeah, do you understand? I took it, and for me, COVID was a piece of cake. The day after I got COVID, I went out on a 4-mile walk. The next day, I mowed my lawn, and on ivermectin, right? So I believe that ivermectin is highly effective. I was troubled that doctors who were saying this thing works were removed from social media, were accused of spreading disinformation by people who were managing government narratives. But that's a different conversation. So what I want to talk about is social media as it operates in the Nigerian space. You know, you are you become a big player, if you like, on social media.
No.
Well, on some level. And part of it is that you have not been shy about your support for the APC and for Bola Ahmed Tinubu, the presidential candidate of the APC. During the election, certain statements were made on social media, okay? And one of those statements were by somebody I considered a friend, Bayo Onanuga, when Bayo said that Igbo people should not interfere anymore in the politics of Lagos. And I found that shocking. And I thought that people from both sides of the aisle would have been outraged and would have called him out for going beyond an area that you shouldn't touch, right? Because you're questioning the very idea of Nigeria itself, in addition to, of course, falsifying what happened in Lagos, that if it were up to Igbos, Tinubu would have won the election. You know, that there were lots of Yoruba people who voted massively against Tinubu. So because that statement of his went viral. It was seen at one point, by the last time I watched it, it was seen by 3 million people. I expected, say, somebody like you, so I don't know how you took it, that statement.
Well, you didn't see my question to him.
Okay.
I asked him, what do you mean by interfering? Do you mean by going out and voting?
And voting, okay.
Because I can't remember the exact words of it, but if you look through my Twitter feed, you will find it. And I asked him, what do you mean by interfering? What do you mean by interfering? Because interfering, people go out and vote, like the rest of us. What are we going to now have a... I can't remember. But I did actually... But you see, because you prefaced what you said by saying that... I mean, I voted for a party and I voted for a candidate. I have not signed in blood. You know, in Iraq, you had to show that you were voting for Saddam Hussein by showing that you used your blood to mark the... No, I just made the choice out of a field of candidates. And that was, as far as I'm concerned, I have not sold my soul to the devil. I have not done... But once you preface it with that, then anything that I say that doesn't fit that narrative is... It doesn't even get seen because we are all now dealing in stereotypes. And once the person's stereotype is that they voted for this person, then they say, it must be because Tinubu is paying you. And I said, bloody wish he would, you know. You know, but this is the reaction. And, you know, I have people who were staunchly behind Buhari. And as I said, I mean, I don't think Silverbird would have been asking me to discuss current affairs on the program if I was only going to come up with a rabid, one-sided view. Because there is generally more than one side. And there may be arguments on one side, arguments on the other. It just happens that I may have preferred one. But that's not relevant when I'm sitting there as a commentator or discussing current affairs. And I think that once you can pigeonhole me, she's an APC supporter. I said that, you know, as for this Tinubu and his, I don't bloody care. I really don't. And, you know, if you want me to get excited about the difference between Tinubu's certificate and his and the school he attended, I'm sorry. Maybe it's because I grew up in an environment, a milieu, in which it was assumed that you're going to go to university, you're going to get a degree, and quote and unquote, you are going to go and get your master's. And so I don't come with this idea that, anybody who hasn't got it, or that, you know, because I recognize that it is actually a degree of privilege to have achieved that. And I don't feel entitled to look down on people who can't, who didn't. I mean, like as I said, one of my tweets, I said that, you know, I mean, Farouk Kperoki had talked about certificates and all the rest of it. And I said, most of us, when they say Chicago State University, Didn't know the difference between Chicago State. You've been at Chicago University. I went, oh, what's our business? It is, oh, sorry. They said, ah, no, Chicago State University cannot be mentioned in the same breath as University of Chicago. I said, ah, sorry, we didn't know. We thought it was the
one. But
the point is that those things, whenever you, whatever you say, and I did, you know, to say that, to call out Bayo for what he said. And I actually spoke to people who know him better than I do and say, ah, he's very angry. And I said, yeah, but even if he's angry, he holds a position. And it's to me, people say a lot of things in the privacy. Oh, I think you were there when my friend, if I said, she wouldn't listen to anything I had to say.
Yeah.
I was actually shocked at that because it suggested to me that, so you can't, even me that you know, you can't see that I'm capable of seeing more than one side of any particular argument. But that, you know, I said, even if he's holding a position, it may not be, at least he's holding a position in the Tinubu campaign. And for that reason, if for no other reason, he ought to have, he could not have been there. But now he has been appointed. And I actually thought that that is the end of his career. But he had just been appointed as one of the president's spokespersons to for one thing or other. And, you know, I mean, I recognize that he was one of those who suffered during the time of Abacha. But I didn't think at that time we were not dealing with, even though there might be some, you know, people who are, you know, the June 12th struggle was it was a source of a lot of discussion and dispute within the human rights community because, you know, we had become pro-democracy activists because we felt that you can't be dealing with human rights in different pockets without addressing the whole issue of the environment in which you are struggling for human rights. I always give the analogy of cholera and the water supply. You may have the cure for cholera, but if you don't tackle the water supply, you have to be running around from place to place dealing with the individual cases of cholera. Whereas if you tackle the water supply and clean it up, then you have fewer cases of cholera. And it's the same thing with human rights. Yes, we have the tools to fight for individual human rights. But if we don't tackle the environment, the water supply of a constitution and all the rest of it, then we will be, you know, running from pillar to post all the time. And we need to do better than that. So, yes, we all knew that that was how we became pro-democracy activists. But it was not a matter. And it may be that, I mean, as I've always said, Gani Fahmy took out a half-page advertisement on June the 11th to say that he's not voting in the June 12th election, doesn't believe in it, the Babangida transition, blah, blah, blah. And yet he turned around to become one of the staunchest pro-June 12th advocates. Now, you may say that it's because he knew Mpeo Abiola during the time of his working for Concord and so on. Or you may say that, he must be bigoted because it happens that Mpeo Abiola is a Yoruba man like him. And what I found disturbing was that a Yoruba person like me is... assumed is labeled a bigot because I happen to be supporting or to be, have decided to vote for Bola Tinubu. But every Igbo person that I know who is perfectly free and is, you know, I don't even blame people for voting for Peter. We just don't sell him to me as a saint because, you know, nobody is a saint in this business. So you make your you make your choice. If you want somebody who looks more saintly, you are free to vote for the person who looks more saintly. If you want somebody who looks more like somebody who can get things done, then you know who you're going to look. But it's this idea that only one group of people was bigoted and the others were picking the best. I mean, come on, give me a break. That did not
go. Yeah.
But yes, people, we've, and I think that it happened that I had already decided that I was going to travel over the weekend of the governorship election. And when the result for Lagos came out, I said, ah, it looks like Sanwo-Olu is in trouble, but I won't be here to vote for him. So we'll have to do. It happened then that they postponed the election. So I was in fact able to vote in Lagos. And I think that it was not so much the fact that Lagos had been lost by Tinubu. It was more the kind of virulence, the naked racism, really, that came out over the Lagos state election. As usual, I can see why one side said this and why another side said that. But I think that, you know, at the end of the day, I would say that the long-term effect, I mean, I don't know if you know late Professor Eberion Wudiwe.
Oh, yeah, yeah, very well.
I could have discussed these matters with him, but I have my closest friends who, as it happens, are evil. I don't discuss politics with them if I can avoid it, because it's painful, really. And
Is it not the case, though, that there are, because there was a generational aspect, and Emeka, you've been very patient. So I actually sent you a text message saying if you are ready to go. Emeka?
Oh,
I sent you a text message asking if you were ready to go, but I want to ask.
15 minutes.
Yes.
I wasn't even.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
There was some generational split in the last elections that were clear, wouldn't you say? I think that for the most part, the young people, including young Yoruba men and women, went for the Labour Party, including, I think, huge elements in the northern parts of Nigeria went for Peter Obi in that election. So I'm wondering if, when you say that there are Igbo people that you find it difficult to discuss politics or the last elections with, whether it's also that you find it difficult to discuss it with young people, because there are lots of young people who looked at Bola Tinubu as representing a certain kind of politics that they saw culminating in their fight at the NSAS movement and the kind of politics that they wanted to disrupt and to move away from, you know, so which was why there was a sense of despondency amongst young people and amongst a lot of Nigerians when Bola Tinubu was declared the winner of the elections. You know, so there were so many different elements. The element of violence that happened in different parts of the country, the hoisting away of ballot boxes, the role of security forces and agencies and so on, and the way in which INEC announces the result of an election, I think, at 4 a.m., you know. And then we're looking at, so when you spoke about not looking down on people on account of their educational certification and so on, I don't think that that's the argument that people are making. The Nigerian Constitution says you can become president or governor with a school certificate if you've gone to high school. But there is a case in Anambra State where Andy Oba, for example, had only a high school certificate, but he was parading himself as somebody with a doctorate. And I took on him, not out of a sense of arrogance that I have a PhD, but I feel that it is important to give an account of yourself to the people that you propose to run their affairs. That if you are going, a man is going to lie on basic questions about which schools did you attend, right? And so on. When were you born? That how are we going to then entrust the management of the affairs of a complex organism called a nation in the hands of such a man? I think that that's what, you know, I mean, the recent hearings, for example, around Tinubu's certificate.
Let me tell you something.
Right?
Let me tell you something, okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I think that my daughter said to me that all her educated friends are voting for Peter Obi. My mechanic, he's a Yoruba man of 40 or so, 40, 50. He's from Ikorodu. He's a Muslim. He said, he's voting for Peter Obi. I was interested. I said, why? He said that, Tinubu is too old. And so, and to me, I said, well, I you can ask people who are close to him, is Tinubu sick? Because there's so much story that Tinubu is sick, that he's demented and all the rest of it. And of course, now you it's possible to see that there was a lot of misinformation. But just as there was misinformation about NSAS, I actually had to pull myself back and read the whole report of the panel, because the report and the evidence before the panel had nothing to do with the end results that they were giving out. Because during the NSAS demonstrations, again, everybody wanted to be on board, to be seen as, you know, we've been like Black Lives Matter, corporate world. So my daughter took some umbrellas from the bank that she was working for at that time, you know, to give out to the, and they said, that they will say, yes, we are going to stay here, because they were convinced that Bola Tinubu was getting money from the NSAS, from the toll gate. And where does that come from? And so there had been this determination to pin the NSAS issue by hook or by crook on Bola Tinubu, so that there were edited videos to show that he was asking what were they doing there, edited to make it sound as if he was talking callously and so on. And so, yes, I've no doubt that a lot of young people in Lagos area were pro, were not just pro Peter Obi, but they were also actively anti Bola Tinubu. But I don't think you can say that for the whole country at all. And in fact, I mean, there will be a belt of people who, once Bola Tinubu picked a Muslim as his running mate, they say, that's it. We have finished with this man. We were trying to swallow the story of it, but when he now picks the Muslim, we are not ready for it. But that is only for one part of the country. It doesn't go for some parts of the country. I mean, the idea that all young people have the same view, I don't find it to be so. I don't find it. It's just that the young people who did not go along with that, they saw how those who were not going along with it were bullied, oppressed, threatened, insulted on social media. And they said, when I'm ready to vote, I'll just quietly go and vote my own vote. And the people that want to be shouting and abusing me, I'll just leave it like that. So that's why it gives the impression that all young people felt this way. We saw what happens to when some actors came out and for Tinubu, the way they were being abused and dragged. And I think that if one were to make the mistake of thinking that the people who kept, I will not talk about the silent majority, mm-hmm. but if the people who came out and were dragged, and not everybody has the energy to spend their life being dragged. And, you know, when people say, like you said, I came out, I say, actually, I try to avoid it. Not because I don't think that I have not invested my personality in the person for whom I vote, but because when, people now came and turned around and said, you voted for this and you have to explain, you have to say, I'm sorry. I expressed my own view about how I'm going to vote for. Did I hold you by the neck and carry you to the polling booth and make you vote? But people now are sort of, you have to justify, you have to apologize. And I say, well, you better, let me leave you to make up your own mind about who you want to vote for. And if you can discern who I'm going to vote for. Don't turn around later and say, I told you to vote for such and such. Make up your own mind. And that's really all that I would say about it. Ooh, we've lost Emeka.
Okay. I think I've driven Emeka away. Is there a problem? We have a problem. Oh my gosh.
Loopy.
Oh. Let me be on the phone to him and see if it is something he can. I was just going to call. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear.
Okay, yes. Is that problem resolved?
But how much longer are we going on?
Okay, so, Emeka.
Because I'm not sure Emeka, that we landed anywhere.
Okay. Say?
I said, how long, much longer are we going? Because I'm not sure that we've actually landed anywhere. We've just been rambling.
I know.
Offside musings.
Offside musings, yes. Emeka, did you want to come in at this point, or should I? Is it the recording? Wow. Okay. Oh, you get dog?
Yes.
So I'll be scared to visit.
Are you scared of dogs?
I've been bitten. Oh my gosh.
Oh,
it's
no,
not
Susie
working.
Cannot bite anything.
With that kind of barking?
He says he can't hear. He thinks that somebody's at the door, so he's gone to... It's
okay,
just somebody walking in front of the door inside the compound.
Yes.
He decided that he was the policeman of that.
Yeah, wow. So Emeka, hello? So basically, are we, what's the update?
You cannot see her?
Okay,
you can't see me and you can't hear me.
Oh my gosh. Oh boy. But can you see me? Oh boy. Do you want to end the recording and we log back in? Okay. Do we wait a few minutes?
This, by the way, so, is.
Oh, that's a cutie. With a lot of PM. Okay. Okay. Yeah. But I moved it to 3:15. So I have about 45 minutes to go. But okay, so you were speaking about the virulent ethnocentrism that you witness.
I said that people who expressed their support for one party were attacked and vilified and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was saying.
Okay, so the virulence that you're talking about came from one side and targeted people on the other side, or
listen, don't try and reinterpret what I'm saying.
Want to understand
some people,
you. Yes.
Some people were accused of bigotry simply because of their choice of candidate. Okay? Mm-hmm. And mostly it was Yoruba people. If they supported Tinubu, they were accused of bigotry. Mm-hmm. Right? Yoruba people did not accuse Igbo people of bigotry for supporting him. My law partner, who is the Yoruba man too, my law partner, his political party was supporting the Nigerian Labour Party and Peter Obi, as well as Gbadebo Rhodes Vival for the governorship of Lagos State. That's why I say that for me, I can't just sort of approach it from the point of view of that everybody who doesn't vote the way that I vote must be mad or insane or evil. And I don't expect them to approach my electoral choices in the same way. But I didn't see that and particularly I didn't see it on social media. And unfortunately, I think that if one spends too much time on social media, you will find that that is amplified. Whereas in the real world, you go out, you have your friends. I mean, on election day, I know how many people were approaching me and asking, where can I go and vote? That, you know, I'm a first time voter. And they were Igbo people. And I would say, this is where I think it's where you should go, or so on and so forth. It was not not, you know, I didn't see it in those terms. But, and I think that even though, I've seen some, let me put it like this. I think that when I saw the election petitions that were, as they were presented to the court, I've done election petitions in my time. I was astonished that no party agents were called to support this claim of a huge swell of people who voted for the Labour Party. I was astonished, actually, because I know that some people mistakenly believed that they were to be, that the results would only be the ones that were taken from the INEC results viewing portal. But if you were paying attention, you would know that is not the case. And I think that, yes, for all of us, there was something suspicious about the fact that INEC could not upload the presidential results, or the ones that they uploaded were blurred in many cases and illegible. But it's not the same thing as saying that those results were not the results. Because what you do when you're complaining about the results that the electoral body is producing is that you bring your agents and you say, it cannot be correct because this is the results from my agents. And that was how, I mean, in 1983, I was parked in Plateau State. And we went with the, and I remember my principal, Chioke Ajayi, you know, like many people in the South, didn't expect to have many literate people. And so these ordinary people would be coming and saying, yes, I was a party agent. I signed this. And he was saying, were you the one who, they said, yes, I was the one. You know, ordinary people who signed and with, you know, this is the evidence you're going to lead, that you, everybody signed the results sheet and this is the one that was given to me. And so this is how you know whether the results sheet that the electoral body is producing is one. And I was surprised that that was not
so, at all. So now, as somebody who has played an important role in electoral issues of electoral integrity, both in Nigeria and indeed in the wider world out there, give me your assessment of the conduct, INEC's conduct of the last elections. What impressed you and what disappointed you?
Well, my own personal experience was that, firstly, the bimodal voter accreditation worked beautifully. In fact, we got there and we were getting ready to use up, and they said, look, it's better, it recognizes your face much better. And so we, and it did, you know, and we voted. And also, this was the second election in which it was no longer a matter of you come for accreditation in the morning, then you go back and you come to vote after you've all been accredited. So to me, it was such a, I won't call it seamless, but at my own polling station, compared to even my experience before, I felt it went beautifully. And I, you know, I was not an election observer or election monitor in this election, but, you know, these are the days when those of us who have bicycles, we can mm-hmm. afford to go out on the road with our bicycles because we're mm-hmm. no longer afraid of being knocked into the road mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. cars because there's no traffic. So I cycled around my neighborhood up to Phalamore, you know, as I said, to occupy space for Green Bad Dog Girls, hung around there, and then, you know, cycled back down Awolowo Road, lots of polling stations there. And I didn't see any problems. And you see, when the Nigerian Bar Association, which actually put monitors out, had its report and said that this was what we saw, people were attacking them and saying, you can't say that blah, 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 that, you know, what about this person? You know, because this thing that you mentioned, okay, about ballot boxes being snatched, anybody would think it was happening all over Lagos State, everywhere, and so on. And we didn't see it. And the NBA said, well, our monitors can only report what they saw. And people were attacking them for not reporting what they didn't see, for not, in fact, following the line peddled by the European Union that there were reports of this, there were reports of that. And honestly, I thought that we would at least have one person come mm-hmm. and say, I was attacked at a polling station, or mm-hmm. I was at the collation center, and the results that were collated, I refused to sign it because it did not reflect what we had. But we didn't see any of that. So I actually felt that despite all the noise and brouhaha, that actually this particular election is one of the best that we've had. And I think that the IREF portal certainly was a disappointment to many people. And when I went to check my own results on the IREF portal, it was blurred, but because I knew what the result had been, I could make it out. But you can't do that. But it's only if you're sort of, you know, when you sort of see and you know that the figure is 8, and then you see it, you say, oh, that's an 8. But for all you know, it could have been a 3 if you hadn't seen. So you tend to see what you are expecting to see. So I think, and whereas the results for the National Assembly election were clear as crystal. So that to me, but then I don't take lightly INEC's complaint that there were attacks and there were attempts to hack in to its, and that's why they say we're going to do our collation manually. And if you were a serious political party, your agents will bring you their results. And that was why, as Fashola said, we knew that we had not won in Lagos because our results from our agents confirmed what the result was. But the people who were saying that the result for Peter Obi was 500,000 more than it was given to him in Lagos, I said, well, you know, where are the people who are going to produce that? So I actually feel that there was a whole ground game of propaganda and lies about what INEC had done, vilification of the INEC chair. And so, I mean, I don't know if you remember in 2010 when I had been invited to attend the Chinua Achebe colloquium. And Atahiru Jaga had just been appointed mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to head INEC. And he was talking about, well, that, you know, we're not going to do accreditation. And I remember speaking to, anyway, one of our colleagues, his name will come to me. And I said, he's your friend, you better talk to him. How can he say that he's not going to do accreditation? With the voters register as it was then, it was a complete work of fiction. How can you now say that you're going to just allow people to come and be voting anyhow? You better speak to your friend, though, because this is idea that we don't have to do open secret anymore. And with our current voters register as it is, it's not going to work. And it's from that point that you've seen improvement and improvement and improvement in the electoral process. There's always room for improvement. But we've seen from other countries that don't even have voter identification, that we actually, compared to some, are ahead. But in regard to, and it was the governorship elections that had taken place where they had allowed people, they had not just had the same manual collation, but people had been able to check what they saw counted at their polling unit, at the results viewing portal, that gave people confidence in the the integrity of the results. So there are definitely things to do. But if you are a candidate, you can't be complaining about that. Me, as an ordinary voter, can be complaining that I didn't see my result at the polling unit, so I'm not satisfied. I can say that. But you, as a candidate, you're not serious if you don't have your agent to back up your story. Mm. And, you know, that to me is where the difference lay. So okay. I expect INEC to do better. Mm-hmm. But as they say, they won't be trying to vote by your vote if there were any other way for them to cook the results. And then you saw also that the IAGA Africa, they also did a parallel vote tabulation. And they said that the two places where their PVT did not tally with the result declared by INEC were Rivers State and Imo State. And I thought, well, Rivers State, you know, there was a lot of dirty work at the crossroads there, but nobody came to get evidence from there. I mean, you know, and they said that the result for P2OB was switched around to the result for APC. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, well, that is something that the agents are certainly going to come and prove. But my surprisation, okay, agents did not come. And, you know, however much you want to abuse the courts, you end up saying that if they can't bring the evidence, you can't blame the court for not giving evidence, giving judgment on the basis of evidence that was not led. But you also then begin to ask yourself, like you saw this woman with the bandage across her head and so on. Wasn't somebody going to come and give evidence about her? Because we know that some of the people that were said to have been killed, that the people who were the relations of the person who was set up, you say, I beg, please, I died of natural, and we've carried him home for burial. You see, so, and you begin to ask yourself, how many of these are actual real cases and how many are not? Because as a lawyer, I know that the way to test the veracity doesn't always get you there. But one way to test the veracity of a claim is to subject it to cross-examination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're not ready to put your witnesses through that, it suggests to me that you know why.
Okay. So, in the run-up to the election, right, Tinubu refused to do any of the debates. He went to the UK and spoke to Chatham House, mm-hmm. and he was distributing questions to members of his delegation. Mm-hmm. In one of his talks to his supporters, he said to them to snatch it and seize it and run with it, power. And all of this rhetoric and all of this refusal to speak directly to Nigerians in a debate fueled a certain perception that either he didn't take Nigerians seriously, the people he wanted to govern, or perhaps that he had a different way of banking the election so that, you know, he didn't have to, as he said, that it was his turn to be president. So it's all of these, in addition to, you know, say what happened in a place like River State, that, you know, led to this perception that his victory, it's, you know, was not on the up and up. How do you respond to
sense?
That?
Well, I mean, I think he won the most votes. He got the plurality of the votes. So if that's the issue, his victory was on the up and up. Mm. Now, and that's why you find the whole contest has dwindled to, yes, okay, he graduated, but is his certificate? That certificate, is it? That's what it's dwindled to, quite frankly. Yes, he was on the up and up. But as I said, okay, I don't approach elections with the idea that My own candidate is a saint, and every other candidate is a devil. I don't. So I would have liked Tinubu, because I would have liked Tinubu to take part in debates. But at the same time, I knew that everything that he was saying was being picked over for the slightest stumble and so on and so forth. And I said, well, that was his choice. It didn't stop. It's not debate that will make me vote for him or not vote for him. Let me say that. But I live in Lagos, so I know what's... It's not that Lagos is a heaven, but at the same time, it's not the hell that people now try to make it out just because somebody said that he's done better in Lagos than other people have done in their own states. But yeah, I would have loved him to come out and debate. I don't think that everybody wanted to be in Chatham House. I don't believe, I don't think it's the, you know, but we, you know, I won't call it quite colo mentality, but nonetheless, everybody wants to be seen there. I don't know why. What can I say? And I actually am not aware of the pick it and run with it, but I can see that it would be taken in the context of not steal the ballot box and run with that, but rather, you know, get power and run with it. But as I said, the fact that I voted for him is because I felt of all the candidates, he was the one that I preferred to see in office compared to the others. It doesn't mean to say that I think he is without fault or that he is the perfect candidate or anything like that. Not at all. Just that he's better than the rest. That's all.
Okay. So there is clearly a certain atmosphere of fracturedness in the country, right? I was just in South Africa with Wole Soyinka 3 weeks ago, and I had a conversation with him, a conversation that lasted an hour and a half at Stellenbosch University. But what he said about the Labour Party coming third went viral and unleashed, and is still unleashing a certain toxic atmosphere in the country. I want to ask you, what's your vision of Nigeria? And as somebody who has worked, collaborated with Igbo and people from other parts of Nigeria, as you have done in civil liberties organization, are you hopeful? Are you optimistic, or at least hopeful, about Nigeria achieving a sense of national identity? If not, what should be done with this space that we call Nigeria? And if you are hopeful or even optimistic, what's the trajectory to this achievement of this vision of a true Nigerian space?
Well, okay, I don't know whether I'm hopeful or not hopeful. I just happen to be a Nigerian. And as I've said, when I was a small girl in London, my father said, never forget you're a Nigerian. I don't know whether he just felt that if he were to tell me, never forget that you're a Yoruba, I would be sort of, you know, as I was then, saying, what's that? What do you mean? I thought we were Nigerians or something. So it may be that he just said, never forget you're a Nigerian, because that was it. And I literally asked somebody, look, help me print out my master's thesis and submit it, because I'm going home to Nigeria to attend law school. And I always knew that I was coming back to Nigeria. And I have two brothers and a sister in Britain. But me, I always knew I was coming back here. So I don't know. I mean, I think that, yes, there's a fracturing. But I think it's also exacerbated by the economic hardships we're going through. And we should be realistic that those economic hardships are not going to vanish overnight. So I think that as long as there isn't an economic soothing of the country, then people will continue to, you know, it will be a matter of you voting. Not that I think that anybody would have done better. But I do think that the obsession with denigrating Nigeria just because you don't like its government or running the country down, I think that's, it's obviously it's unfortunate, but I don't know whether it's going to change in the near future, because there's now a tendency to see everything through ethnic coloured glasses.
Mm-hmm.
The other day, we have a world record holder in 100 metres hurdles, and she ran into some trouble with the doping authorities. And it was almost as though the issue of whether or not she should be supported or not depended on whether you were in the same ethnic group as this young woman who we had all thought had done the nation proud. Same thing, we had somebody who entered the Guinness Book of Records because she had a cookathon. And again, it was a matter of, well, it turned out that she had previously had a political opinion. How dare she? You know? And again, it was a matter of, well, we're now going to bring out a Yoruba person who's also going to cook. You know, this is the ridiculousness, but it is ridiculousness. I think we should recognize it as ridiculousness. And of course, the heat that descended on Professor Soyinka because of his, and this is somebody who was kind of supporting the idea of the Labour Party. Then suddenly he now said something that was not, 1,000% in support of the Labour Party, and he instantly became that Yoruba devil. I mean, come on. We can't be doing that. We can't. We simply can't. And it may be, because I don't make the mistake of always saying that maybe when we have more money in our, more food on our table and so on, we will do better, because people in the United States are not poor, and they're divided into, is Trump the devil incarnate, or is Trump, the prelude to the second coming?
Could you pause? Emeka just sent me a text saying that he can neither see nor hear you. And he's the one recording this. So we have to stop and restart. We have to stop and restart. I can't hear or see her. Okay, so it's been such a bracing conversation. I'd like to end on a note that we actually started with earlier in the conversation. It has to do with your work in civil liberties. Looking back over the years, what are some of the issues that you see pertaining to civil liberties in Nigeria that are urgent in your view? And what are some of the what's part of the progress that we've made in that regard?
The thing is, okay, that I stopped being president of the Civil Liberties Organization as long ago as 2003. That's 20 years ago.
Yes.
So it would be ridiculous for me to pretend that I'm up to date. But I did chair the Civil Society Panel on Police Reform in about 2013 or some period. And I think that even though there are these big issues of politics and voting and so on and so forth, where the rubber hits the road is this issue of our relations with the police. And it's unfortunate that despite all, I was on the Police Service Commission, and it's unfortunate that there are improvements. I mean, you now can tell from the fact that you have the police spokespersons on Twitter or X, and people raise issues with them and they have to respond and they want to be able to give a good response. So there are improvements even in that regard. And, but I do think that there are still too many stories of people finding themselves extorted. And it's not, and the thing is that if the police were actually catching the criminals. But when I also consider that kidnappers are able to collect their ransom and go away with their ransom, and there doesn't seem to be any mechanism for, you know, apart from storming kidnappers' dens and, you know, but actual detective work, intelligence work, and so on, to nip, to catch them, even when they are think that they've got away with it. To mm-hmm. me, those are the areas, this issue that brings us out every Saturday for Bring Back Our Girls, the fact that we don't have a proper national, you know, register of missing persons that people can check. And it's not just kidnapped victims. It could be somebody who had been arrested by the police, vanished by the police, forgotten by the police, who didn't have, somebody who was just on a visit, had come maybe from, as we saw in the time of when the CLA was founded, came from Maiduguri, and then you found yourself arrested. And for 20 years, you were just there, you know. And there was when they came on police visits, on prison visits, that's when they say, oh, what are you doing here? What have you been here for? And then you say, well, I don't remember. Those are the sorts of things actually that led to the founding of the CLA. When Clement Wanko, you know, and his priest would tell him, we went for a prison visit and we saw these people. Can't you lawyers do something about it? And so on. So I think that if we could see some improvement there and in our security, of course, the economic issue, you know, as they always say, is the economy stupid, is a huge problem. But when you deal with those things, you will find less of people worrying about, is this person a Yoruba or whatever, or all the rest of it. I mean, the other day, the Lagos state government had been going around saying, all you markets must clean up your act, and so on. And they were doing it, and they do it. Well, when they got to Ladikwa, which is a famous spare parts market, you find many Igbo people there. The story was going around that they say that if we can bring X amount of money, that they will leave us. And so the Lagos state man said that he better clean up your market, Tori. And I said, yes, of course, somebody would now come with that story. And because you're a receptive audience, to feel that they're now targeting us, you know, that we are being targeted because we are Igbo traders in Lagos, you may start to think that it is true. Whereas there's some wise guy who's trying to collect some money and put it. And of course, when they now started cleaning up the market, then the market is to be reopened. But when you when we've got this narrative that's going on in Lagos, and people saying, I will not rent to an Igbo person. I will not do this. I will not do that, and so on and so forth. I don't know how Lagos itself can even be what Lagos is supposed to be, if that mentality takes hold. And you know, sorry, time for me to feed the dog.
Okay.
I remind myself with an alarm. He won't start if we go on for a short one. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not even a matter of as I always say, and I said at the beginning, it's not because I'm a saint or because I'm we should all be good Christians. It's because it's enlightened self-interest. This is what will work for all of us. And I think we need to think about not just what will work for me, because what will work for me, if it works so anti you, then it is not going to work for me either, you know. So we need to look at what will work for everybody. And, you know, people would have been saying, why should they be doing train, you know, this new train that we have in Lagos? Why should they do it to mile two? You know, people will say, well, and people are enjoying that train. Then there's no longer a matter of the train is only for Lagosians or for Yoruba people or that. Why should they build train for Igbo people to go to mile two? And no. Everybody's enjoying that train. And that's how it should be. That is how it should be. And that, to me, is you may, you have to do, the government has to do some work to soothe over the kind of rhetoric that came out, because Sanwo-Olu felt that, you mean I will lose to this joker? It can't happen. And he played the ethnic card. He's going to have to work hard. He cannot make a difference to you. You will go to your school, you will go to your hospital or your primary health care or whatever it is that you do, and you will do what you do, you know. But it's still a lingering undertone of, so we're not really welcome here. We're not really welcome. I mean, I don't know, you guys know how it is when the African-Americans come out and say, we are foundational African-Americans, and you guys from Africa are, you don't qualify, or whatever it is that they say. But we are here now, we are part of it. We're part of this, we're part of it. You know, I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, thank you. Thank you very, very much for your generosity of insight and of time to join us on this podcast. It's been really a very enjoyable time conversing with you. We've known each other for some years now. And we hope that when next we call you, that you'll make yourself available and, you know, offer your insight.
If you tell your people that you're calling, they will say, that woman, that big show, you bring her here again. Talking. These lawyers are
Yeah, so thank you. Thank you very much, Ayo, for joining us. And on behalf of
thank
my
you
co-host,
for inviting
yes, on behalf of my co-host, Emeka Onyagwa, we...
Your silent host.
Emeka has been silent today, but I think that he's been wrestling with all kinds of technical issues. So when next we invite you, I'll leave the platform up to Emeka to have at it. So thank you and have a brilliant rest of the day in Lagos.
I wish you all the same. Bye.
Bye-bye now.